In the last couple of issues of this series, we experimented with a new feature in which I met with two faculty members who presented and discussed real cases from their practices. We again take a shot at this new format, this time with Drs. Hal Burstein and Joyce O'Shaughnessy, beginning with a woman seen by Dr. Burstein for a second opinion.
I can, briefly discuss the patient I truly saw yesterday in a consultation. This was a young woman in her mid-40s who had presented about 2 years ago with large left-sided breast cancer and palpable left-sided axillary lymphadenopathy. And she had received neoadjuvant chemotherapy with AC followed by paclitaxel on a dose-dense schedule. And she'd had a partial response to therapy and went for lumpectomy, which would have been as recently as this past fall. And at the time of her surgery, she had a little over 1 centimeter of residual tumor, and she had no disease in her axilla.
Maybe I could just stop at this point, because you've just described a dilemma that a lot of people have tremendous questions about and you have a lot of interest in, which is the patient who's had neoadjuvant therapy, Joyce, and still has significant residual tumor. Is triple negative tumor, pretty fair amount of residual tumor at surgery, Joyce. How do you approach a patient like that clinically, and what clinical trials are ongoing or about to begin that are going to address this question?
In the triple negative patient with a fair amount of tumor burden, as Hal described, I generally try to get a PET scan up front, and I don't always get PET scans, but particularly in these very highly proliferative breast cancers that I find that, at least in my own experience, when they have a lot of axillary adenopathy, when I do PET CTs, sometimes you find subclinical lymphadenopathy and intramammary lymph node chain, sometimes low cervical, occasionally even in the mediastinum. And I do that for two reasons. One, if patients are very chemotherapy sensitive and have a chance at a decent prognosis, then you can include those nodal beds in the radiation port. But the second reason I do it is because if I have any documentation of metastatic disease, there may be an opportunity outside of a clinical trial to add bevacizumab if they do not get a PCR. I do it for two reasons. So I don't know whether she had any staging studies or, because see, the thing is obviously is that the nodes may or not be enlarged. So CT scans, may not tell you everything you want, but these are so highly proliferative, these triple negatives, that even small.
Any imaging to work with here?
She had had a baseline PET staging, which had suggested disease in the breast, in the ipsilateral axilla, and then there had been a lot of review and discussion because on the PET scan there had been very equivocal findings in some of the other regional lymph nodes, including the contralateral right axilla. And so it was one of those cases where PET really muddied the waters more than clarified them, and she had been treated with curative intent.
So Joyce, how might you, this patient came to you at that point, after having had surgery, for a second opinion or an opinion, what might you have done off study?
I usually do bring in non-cross-resistant chemotherapy agents, sort of in the absence of any other data, just trying to turn to other agents with either a proven track role in the adjuvant setting or where some preclinical data have suggested some good preoperative activity.
So what specific, this lady had dose-dense ACT?
I would probably choose capecitabine and a platinum agent, a doublet, and obviously, capecitabine is non-cross-resistant. The platinums, from work from the FABR and other places suggest some activity in the triple-negative disease, probably with bevacizumab, to tell you the truth. Just off-study, just trying to give this patient the best chances of cytoreduction and disrupting that micrometastatic niche that she might have.
So, Hal, what happened to this lady?
She did not receive further systemic therapy. The data on that really are lacking, and whether or not more chemotherapy or other treatments would be helpful is unclear. She did receive radiation therapy to the breast and to the regional lymph nodes after her chemotherapy.
What was the next time point?
So she was then followed expectantly, and within about 3 or 4 months, she had developed changes in the ipsilateral left breast. She had a red rash. Initially, it was thought that it might be a cellulitis, and she received a course of antibiotics. Our breast cancer audience can imagine where this is going, which is that she had recurrent disease. A skin biopsy eventually confirmed recurrence within the left breast. At that point, she had a repeat staging PET CT scan that showed changes in the left breast, in the left supraclavicular lymph node chain, the right axilla again, perhaps a bone lesion, and some internal mediastinal lymph nodes. There was a pericardiac lymph node, and probably one of the AP window lymph nodes were hot on the PET scan.
What was her racial ethnic background?
She was actually a Hispanic woman.
Joyce, I hear about this issue of African Americans and triple negative disease. How much of a correlation is there?
I think it's pretty strong. And I'll tell you clinically, and I don't know of any data, whereas, you know, at least with Lisa Carey's work in the African Americans, we see this. But I would also add the younger Hispanic women to the poor prognosis category. It's interesting, and I don't know whether it's going to ultimately boil down to P53 mutational status in these triple negatives or what, but the Hispanic women and the African American women, generally speaking, in my experience, do fairly poorly, although I certainly can think of one Hispanic woman in particular with 10 positive nodes 10 years ago, triple negative disease, flight attendant, who is NED. She's a marathon runner, skinny as a stick in terms of her lifestyle factors, whether that makes any difference or not. She's a young Hispanic woman. But generally speaking, I've had poor success with standard chemotherapy and these triple negatives with young Hispanics. And Cindy Osborne, my partner, who was at Parkland, she has a collection of these young Hispanic gals, and they don't do well.
Is there stuff in the literature on this?
Just in Cindy's. She had an abstract at ASCO. This past, she's been putting it every 6 months. She puts it into one meeting with some updates on
Interesting. So this lady, had she had an opinion rendered in terms of what to do?
So she had begun therapy with reinduction chemotherapy. She was actually receiving docetaxel plus carboplatin. She'd had two cycles of that. Her first cycle had been complicated by febrile neutropenia. With her second cycle, she received growth factor support. She'd had what you might describe as a partial clinical response. There was less erythema. Some of the lymph node burden clinically had improved, and she came to discuss what directions to go with her care.
What was the docetaxel dose?
I think she was getting 75 of docetaxel and carboplatin and an AUC of 6.
I mean, it's interesting, you know, a young woman getting a febrile neutropenia with that dose. Do you think that might have been related to the recent chemo?
You know, I think it's certainly possible, though. Why exactly she had that isn't clear.
So what opinion did you give to her?
Well, it seemed like she was having a minor response to this chemotherapy, and so we suggested another cycle of it to see if we could continue on that. But what we started to map out for her was a dialogue about this particular variant of breast cancer being triple negative breast cancer and some of the other directions that people might go with such tumors in the way of clinical trials or other treatment options, with the sense that it wasn't clear how much benefit chemotherapy by itself might be bringing to her at this point.
So what specific trials or treatment did you talk to her about?
We talked about a couple things down the road. One would be introducing a drug that Joyce mentioned, bevacizumab. The data for its use in more heavily refractory breast cancer are not quite so compelling. Kathy Miller's original study of anthracycline and taxane-treated patients who got capecitabine with or without bevacizumab did not show a major clinical advantage for adding bevacizumab. On the other hand, many of us have been thinking that at least that going after the angiogenesis pathway offers something different, and certainly in patients like this, and we've all had many patients like this in our practice, where it just doesn't seem like chemotherapy itself is going to turn the tide, there is a temptation to look to drugs like bevacizumab. But increasingly, we are also developing specific clinical trials and participating in specific clinical trials for the so-called triple negative type breast cancers. And so at our institute, we actually have now several phase 2 trials specifically focusing on triple negative tumors where they are offered either novel therapies or combinations of therapy. And
what specific therapies, like at this point, for example?
Yeah, so the studies that we have open right now would be a randomized study of a small molecule VEGFR inhibitor versus chemotherapy in a randomized fashion. We also have an open label phase 2 study of a drug called dasatinib, marketed as Sprycel, based on some preclinical data that perhaps the multikinase inhibition of the SRC pathway might be more important in triple negative disease. I think that it's not that it's far-fetched, but I think it's sort of a limited preclinical rationale. And, you know, mostly I introduce these as a way of saying that we really think about this disease ultimately is going to have different needs than other types of breast cancer.
Assuming she doesn't want to participate in a study or she's not eligible for any study and that she at some point has progressive disease on the current carbo-docetaxel, again, assuming her clinical status is about the same, what would you be thinking about doing clinically?
Well, we have a long list of agents that have been studied in advanced breast cancer, and we would start reaching for them. She was currently receiving platinum-based chemotherapy. There's been a lot of discussion about platinum-based chemotherapy, particularly for triple-negative tumors. At this point, you know, the literature doesn't really suggest whether those women preferentially do better or not do better with platinum-based treatment, though, as I said, she was having a suggestion of an activity there, so we left her on that. Then the other choices would be many familiar agents, capecitabine, vinorelbine, gemcitabine, and so on, through the familiar chemotherapy options for advanced breast cancer.
What about bevacizumab?
Yeah, I would probably try bevacizumab at some point in this patient, though, again, the real magnitude of benefit for a woman like this is probably not clear, and since she's already had a lot of taxane therapy at this point. The question is, what would you give it with? I suppose you would offer it with capecitabine based on the safety data that had been accumulated there. Though, as I mentioned in the initial randomized trial, that didn't seem to be such an active combination in the refractory setting.
And then there was more data reported at ASCO by George Sledge.
Yes, George Sledge showed the Excalibur data, which was a first-line trial, and that had a reasonable response rate of an open-label phase 2 work with bevacizumab plus capecitabine and confirmed the safety experience. We've actually had institutional experience looking at vinorelbine plus bevacizumab, as that's a class of chemo she may not have had already. We might try that. But ultimately, the concern here is if she's progressing so quickly through very historically effective chemotherapies, that it just may not be that sensitive a tumor.
Joyce, what would you be thinking about in this? Again, it's the same situation, but, you know, progressive disease with a carbodocetaxel.
Just to mention, we're going to bring the data on cetuximab, you know, irinotecan, carbo plus minus cetuximab. We'll have those data at Santa Ana. And that was in a half were triple negative, half were ER positive hormone refractory, about 163 patients, randomized phase 2. Don't know. We'll see. We're going to do the analysis.
You don't have the data yet?
No. We're going to put it in a late breaker.
I mean, I wasn't aware there was much activity with cetuximab and breast cancer, is there?
Been looked at. It was Lisa Carey. We simultaneously started
this
two different...
This is triple negative?
Half triple negative, half ER positive hormone.
Because I have heard that in terms of triple negative, supposedly maybe having more EGFR. Is that the case? Or?
Triple negatives do have more EGFR, but I heard from the BMS folks that the Spore was doing a randomized phase 2 in metastatic disease, either a single agent cetuximab or... single-agent cetuximab with single-agent carboplatin, I mean, together, you know, not just one chemo drug. And I heard that they closed the single-agent arm of it because of 14 patients, no response, or something along those lines. I don't know the specifics of it, but that the single-agent wasn't looking that great, which would not surprise me, just one molecule among this triple-negative disease. We did two DNA damaging agents.
I guess it'd be pretty surprising if it had significant activity.
It would be surprising if it had significant activity. That is for sure. That is for sure.
So off study, what about this lady?
The major hypothesis that we have two clinical trials going on looking at this hypothesis with different agents is this issue of whether or not the triple negatives have lost their homologous recombination. You know, this is what Peru says. Triple negative, ninefold elevated risk of BRCA1. BRCA1 is a homologous recombination in addition to other things it does. Peru thinks that all triple negatives have lost their major big DNA repair, you know, chopping up and putting the chromosomes back together, the real homologous recombination. And when you lose that, you're more dependent on nuclear excision repair, NER. And some very interesting early clinical data with Yondelis, trabectotin, the C-sponge.
Yondelis?
Yondelis is a ortho J&J drug that looks very promising in sarcomas, amazing activities in soft tissue sarcomas, being predominantly, so that'll probably be an accelerated approval, but it's...
What kind of agent is it?
It is a DNA damaging drug.
DNA damaging drug.
And they've done beautiful work looking at their early data. If your HR is gone, your homologous recombination is gone, but your NER is intact, your nuclear excision repair, that's where the responses seem to come in triple negatives and HER2 positives.
Did I ever tell you that I call her the Encyclopedia of Breast Cancer? I mean, it's interesting how both of you just gravitate towards trial, because I guess the bottom line is our standard options really are not that great. But docs in practice
have
do want to know
decisions,
what you would do. And I want to know, what do you think most likely you would do with this lady?
Off trial.
I mean, would you consider following her? I mean, if she's symptomatic from these local recurrences?
She's growing with the inflammatory.
She had soreness in the chest.
Is that right?
And obviously had side effects from the chemotherapy.
But other than that, she felt pretty well?
Well, that's right. She did not have extensive visceral disease at this point.
Did she have actually known disease outside that local area?
Yes, there was probably a bone lesion.
Okay. So, Joyce, bottom line, what do you think? Because I want to go on to another case. What do you think you might have done?
I agree with Hal. I would definitely push on the platinum. And I generally tend to try to utilize these standard agents like capecitabine. I find, and there's some documentation in the literature preclinically on this, it's very slight, that if these patients are ACT refractory like this, they generally speaking don't get a lot of benefit, as Hal has said, from our standard options.
This is a few months after treatment,
right?
Yes, that's not good.
And so the DNA damaging agents, it's interesting she's having a little benefit from carbo. I try to get agents such as irinotecan, mitomycin C. Both Charlie Shapiro and Bob Livingston have data from phase 2 trials of CPT-11 mito. Just 3 doses of mito and you avoid the HUS and the severe stem cell depletion. Documented phase 2 activity in very late line, very refractory patients. I tend to gravitate towards agents. Our irinotecan carbo experience is very, very good. That's a very active, well-tolerated
combo. And triple negative specifically?
Yeah. And again, do I have the data to tell you? No. But in my anecdotic, I mean, my patients with triple negative have done very well with it.
Okay. I want to go into one of your cases, Joyce. And if you have one that's ER positive, that'd be good. If not, that's fine too. But just one follow-up question to Hal, which is, I'm sure one of the things that is a concern of this lady is maybe uncontrolled localized disease in the face of already having radiation therapy. Any local therapy modalities that you have available at Dana-Farber in that kind of a situation, hyperthermia, anything?
Well, there's sort of two broader questions. I mean, one is this whole issue of surgical mastectomy in patients who have metastatic disease.
Right.
As you know, there's this emerging literature that patients who have a mastectomy seem to do better. The strong suspicion is that is not typically describing patients such as we've seen here who have recurrence so quickly after adjuvant chemotherapy, really neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So we'll leave that for another conversation day. For the most part, we view this as systemic disease. I mean, this really is metastatic disease in the skin, probably contralateral, axilla, and so forth. And so our treatments really are, for the most part, systemic. There are groups that have had attempts at hyperthermia with radiotherapy. And in some small randomized trials, that seems to be effective, particularly for chest wall recurrences, at offering some palliation. A lot of it depends on how large the area you're anticipating treating is. It is a technique that is not necessarily widely available because some centers have the resources where they've built hyperthermia facilities and some do not. And how that really would integrate into the modern experience where you're offering multiple lines of chemotherapy isn't known. So for the most part, in someone who's already had radiation therapy, we would probably just focus on her chemotherapy options.
Okay, Joyce, let's go into your case.
I have a mid to late 50s-year-old African-American woman who presented now 5 years ago with 10-positive node invasive lobular cancer. And she had mastectomy, and staging evaluation was negative. And she had AC followed by taxane adjuvant therapy and was then placed on an aromatase inhibitor. I believe it was anastrozole with, of course, post-mastectomy radiation therapy. She was doing well and had went for a routine colonoscopy 2 years later and was found in her colon to have a solitary flat 1 by 1 centimeter area of lobular invasive cancer, which the GI doc was able to resect.
Wow.
Extensive, thorough evaluation with every imaging study known to mankind, including bilateral marrow biopsies, were done because we've checked her 27, 29 at that time, and it was like over 1,000. And every time I would check it thereafter, it was rising, clearly rising in the face of anastrozole, totally asymptomatic.
The markers were continuing to rise after this lesion was taken out. Just parenthetically, Hal, what is the issue there with invasive lobular in the GI tract?
This is a well-described clinical association. Lenolobular tumors seem to have slightly different tissue predilections than ductal carcinomas when it comes to initial site of metastasis. Because they're more, almost always ER positive and almost always HER2 negative, they are less frequently going to visceral sites as initial manifestations of metastatic disease. And by classic teaching, you would more likely think of them going to bone or serosal surfaces, such as the pleura or the intra-abdominal cavity. I'm not aware that there's a particular link to intrinsic GI things, but you know, the other variation would be here with sometimes that infiltrative sort of linitis plastica presentation that one can see with lobulars where they get percolation through the gastric lining.
So this lady was sort of supposedly stage 4 NED.
Correct.
Yet having progressive tumor markers rising on anastrozole.
Correct. I could find nothing, including her marrow, which I was a bit surprised at because she had 10 positive nodes at presentation, nothing in the marrow. We elected to continue her on anastrozole, and we couldn't find anything. She was feeling great, and so we continued on the anastrozole. I had her re-scoped like a year later to check out her GI tract, make sure I wasn't missing anything clean. And then after about 2 to 3 years on the anastrozole, and I, her tumor marker would keep, you know, I'd be seeing her every 2-3 months, she'd be up another 500 points on her 27-29, so I kept looking, and because the abdominal cavity is a very, very common site, I look for early signs of hydronephrosis, and so on one particular abdominal CT scan, she had some strandy stuff around the perinephric area and a little early hydronephrosis, it was called. And so I took that as a sign of, okay, maybe there's something in her GI tract and I'm maybe getting a little trouble in her kidneys. And I switched her at that point to Aromacin. And she didn't really get much benefit in the sense of her tumor marker didn't come down. And so it kept going. And I still was not able to really find it anywhere at all. But she started losing a little bit of weight. And I switched her at that point to Megestrol Acetate. And she actually responded. Her tumor marker actually, for the first time, started going down, not dramatically. So, however, she did pick up a few pounds, which was good. But she got about 6 to 9 months out of the Megestrol Acetate. And then she started to progress and was getting a little bit anemic, losing a little bit more weight. And with the being documented in the colon and the perinephric stuff, I was thinking gut. And so I placed her on halitestin. And the generic of halitestin is androxymesterone.
Did she ever get fulvestrant?
No.
How about tamoxifen?
She never got tamoxifen. I have been burned with a capital B on numerous occasions with the lobulars with fulvestrant. And I have also tried tamoxifen, not as much. Very interesting paper, and I'm going to mention it in one of my talks that you assigned me. Dick Santon just published a paper in Cancer Research that showed with fulvestrant that it moves the ER from nuclear to cytoplasmic and it associates with EGFR. And it doesn't happen in all cancers. We know this very well. We know the data. But there's something about the lobulars, and I have just had 8 to 10 experiences with definite disease going dramatically in the wrong direction. So I stay away from the ER antagonists like fulvestrant and tamoxifen. I've had a few, one or two, and that could be strictly coincidence, but I've not been impressed. Lobulars are very common in the metastatic setting, even though they're only 15% of adjuvant cases, because they are not that responsive to chemotherapy and endocrine therapy. They comprise 1/3 of my metastatic practice. This gal has had a fantastic response to halitestin. I had her on, worked her up to 10 QID, which is the highest dose. Very, very, very significant, month after month after month after month, down, down, down. She started losing some weight last time I saw her, so I cut her back to 2 because her marker's going in the right direction.
How low are her markers now?
She's down to like 12, 1500, and I think she had been up to 5, 6,000.
Any problems with the halitestin, you know, voice changes, hair growth, anything?
More hair on her legs, she told me the other day. But that's about nothing facial.
Major.
No, nothing major. Most ER-positive breast cancers, like 80, 90%, have the androgen receptors. I've been impressed with the halitestin in the lobulars. It's one of my go-to drugs in lobular cancer. But I stay away from androgen receptors.
Have anti-androgens like casdexmin or bicalutamide been used?
You know, I've never seen a trial, Neil. We need that trial.
So how?
Well,
a lot to swallow here. What does this all mean?
It's interesting. I'm not sure that the literature supports this idea that lobulars are more resistant to the standard hormone therapies. It's an interesting observation.
They just never subsetted it down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because historically, it's been said that size for size, node for node, you know, lobulars and ductals fare very comparably if they're all ER positive.
But I don't think they're ever really looked at separately in, you know, trials of metastatic disease, are they? There's never enough of them.
Not as treatment trials. Now, this would be looking at the adjuvant experiences from the registries and things like
right.
that.
Right.
But their natural history is so indolent, it's hard to tell what's natural history and what's actual response. You know
what I mean? Like, for example, did they look at that in the ATTACK trial or the BIG trial? I don't remember
not
seeing
to my
that.
Knowledge that I've
I think it's just not enough. It's, you know. So but any other comments about this patient? I mean, would you try fulvestrant or tamoxifen?
Well, Chuck Vogel used to say that he's got a dozen different kinds of endocrine therapy. And I give Joyce kudos, as always, for thinking outside the box and reaching for some older drugs that people may not, I mean, I don't think our fellows have ever seen use of halitestin. If you start giving them estradiol back,
I do that too.
Yeah, Chuck does that
that's,
also.
The next trick.
We actually interviewed a woman on DES that Chuck had.
And one of my favorite colleagues, Leroy Parker, Dana-Farber, who has snow white hair and wears bow ties, but he's another one of these guys and he's seen it all and he'll play that out. He has a few wonderful cases where, you know, decades worth of hormone manipulations and interruptions in therapy. It's hard to say exactly what's going on. It's an unusual case in that the markers have been so markedly elevated without more measurable disease. So there are many interesting parts to the case. So I'm glad she's doing well. What else can one say?
Do you have another case?
Hormone receptor positive disease. And this was a premenopausal woman who probably had what was in retrospect a neglected breast cancer. By the time she sort of sought medical attention, she had a large tumor within the breast, and staging studies suggested bone metastases. And her tumor was hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative.
She was premenopausal?
She was premenopausal.
About how old?
She was in her early 40s.
Regularly menstruating, though.
She was having regular menses at that point, that's right. And so we began her on bisphosphonate therapy for her bone lesions and began combined endocrine therapy with ovarian suppression and tamoxifen. And she actually had a very handsome period of tumor control. We took out her ovaries surgically at some point down the road and continued her on the tamoxifen therapy. And eventually she progressed in bone, so we switched her to an aromatase inhibitor. And she's been on that now for 8 or 9 months. And we don't follow her marker so closely, but she's having somewhat more bone symptoms, and her bone scan suggested perhaps evolution of her disease. These bone scans are always hard to sort of interpret with precision, but she was having more symptoms, and it seemed like that was probably the case. So we had restaged her. She did not have significant visceral disease. And so the question was, you know, do you continue endocrine therapy? Do you try for more? Do you try some chemotherapy, which she really hadn't had? And my colleague at Mass General, Paul Goss, has this very interesting concept of actually withdrawing aromatase inhibitors. And so he has a trial for that. And she sort of wanted just a break from treatment. And she didn't want to do the study, but she wanted a break from treatment. She's a bit of an eccentric character, but she wanted to go and just not take anything. So she stopped her aromatase inhibitor therapy. And the astonishing thing, maybe it's not so astonishing, it's not so profound, but she'd been fine.
And is she responding or just staying the same?
Staying the same. Bone pains, you know, good days and bad days, but she's certainly not worse. And I keep trying to, when she comes into clinic, please, you know, I want you to do something. And she's very content to do nothing.
If you were going to do something specifically in terms of endocrine therapy, what would it be?
Oh, well, you know, this is the usual suspects here, I think, would be to switch her. She'd been on a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor, and I think the choice would be either to switch her to a steroidal aromatase inhibitor such as exemestane, or certainly we use a lot of fulvestrant in this setting as well, and those would be the choices we'd probably reach for. Or, you know, you'd think about chemotherapy. She really didn't want chemotherapy.
But Joyce, this is really the effect situation that Bill Gradishaw reported in December 2006 that she would be facing. Can you talk about what you took away from that trial? I basically randomized between the two choices you just talked about, which is exemestane and fulvestrant.
And that was a really reassuring trial to me because it was huge. Well done, prospective, really showing us that we've got some choices for patients like this. You know, she can really go on to aromatase, or she could really go on to Faslodex and have about a 30%, 33% clinical benefit rate. I thought it was a very, very well done, reassuring study.
I think the other thing that came out is they used the loading dose, and there's been this debate about that the last few years, but kind of it seems like since that trial was reported, it seems like a lot of people are kind of settling into that, or maybe not. I don't know. Do you use it?
I must say I vary. I have been doing and finding no problems with reimbursement, giving fulvestrant 250 every 3 weeks for 5 doses. You know, it takes 5 doses to come to steady state. So I've been trying to compress the schedule, but still have not.
You're trying to see semi-loading dose.
You're trying to just make sure that you can get it paid for. The problem is if you give it every 2 weeks per load, you might run the risk.
Whereas,
you know, if you have it on different months, but it's every 3.
Reimbursement strategy.
Yeah, it's about rates reimbursement strategy, absolutely.
So you know, if that's not an issue, would you just go ahead with the straightforward load? Is that the hesitation? Or?
Yes, only because I started doing this, you know, years ago. So just trying to get it loaded, basically, because there was always this question about the dose, even though it was not clear.
Same thing for you, Hal. If you can get paid for it, you're going to use a loading dose
or not? I actually don't know what we get paid for and what we don't. You know, you're right that after that data where they published the pharmacokinetic data suggesting that the load was associated with a more rapid achievement of therapeutic levels than the historic monthly administration, I think that was most valuable in the context of that study for arguing that they gave the fulvestrant at least as best as we know how, which if the study had been an equivalent result and they hadn't done that, people might have said, well, they didn't give fulvestrant the right way or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but I want to go back to something Joy said, which is the clinical benefit rate was about a third. And of course, that's accurate. But remember, clinical benefit rate just means the cancer hasn't gotten worse over 4 to 6 months. The actual response rate in both arms of that trial was low, 4 or 5%, something like that. So that's okay, because objective response and stabilization of disease historically in the endocrine literature have actually done fairly comparably. But the point I was trying to make about this case is this woman would have also had clinical benefit from doing nothing. And
right.
I think one has to be a little skeptical looking so vigorously at these CBRs and things as we sometimes do. Because
how long is she going now?
She's only 4 months into this, so it's hard to say
so
what's going
to
happen.
Normally, you have to get to 6 months? Is that?
It actually varies from trial to trial. In fact, some studies report clinical benefit if you simply fail to progress at your first staging or so forth. So you have to read the fine print. I think I forget the actual numbers in the EFFECT trial as to how long the CBR.
They used the more traditional.
A third of the patients went 6 months without progression. That seems just more
30%.
Than I remembered from the Kaplan-Meier.
We'll check it. We'll check it. We always fact check.
The point I was really trying to get at was this issue that it's not clear if you're just following a very indolent natural history or if you're actually changing the natural history. But as the case Joyce had a few moments ago underscores, with these endocrine-sensitive tumors, there really is tremendous play, and the pace of these things still, after a decade of caring for these women, continues to impress and surprise me. And I think that we see a lot of consultation cases where women who have hormone receptor positive disease have had every chemotherapy under the sun, and they haven't had endocrine therapies in 3 years or 4 years because they've been so busy getting chemo this and chemo that. And you're like, well, have you thought about, you know, an old tamoxifen or even just second and third line endocrine therapy? And then I think that for a variety of reasons, we perhaps don't give all these endocrine manipulations their full due sometimes. Now, obviously, not everybody is so fortunate that they can get away without chemotherapy.
So one final question to Joyce. Do you think there theoretically might be a place for fulvestrant in the adjuvant setting, either as delayed therapy, which there's been discussion about looking at it, or more specifically, if we could test it in combination with an AI? Do you think that people, if we could test it, you would see benefit of combining fulvestrant with an AI in the adjuvant setting?
I think the answer is yes, possibly. I think that perhaps fulvestrant, because we don't have compliance issues, and if people really, well, if they come in for their injection, we won't have compliance issues as opposed to daily oral therapy and sometimes women with a lot of other things on their plate in life. I think that it's certainly possible that in particular subsets, particularly...
I mean, it's being studied in metastatic disease, and I guess if that shows something promising, that might be a consideration at some point. I mean, Hal, any thoughts? Do you think that strategy has potential?
Well, you know, in the ATAC trial, we learned that combining tamoxifen with an aromatase inhibitor didn't meaningfully improve on the prognosis, so I think it's something that would have to be studied. On the other hand, you know, the people who do a lot of scientific work with this drug maintain that because it leads to substantial downregulation of estrogen receptor and degradation of the receptor, that there may be something to that. And so, as you say, I think there is sufficient rationale for certainly doing trials where you're looking at AI alone versus AI plus fulvestrant in either the metastatic or the adjuvant setting. And similarly, there's interest in using it as an extended adjuvant treatment, as you mentioned, though coming in monthly for a good size shot as opposed to taking a pill is something that, you know, is going to be ultimately more of a challenge for patients. And so you'd want to see some really compelling data, I think, before pursuing that.
Okay, Joyce, let's go into your case.
I have a really interesting case for you, Neil, and I'm bringing you a little gift here because we're going to write this up and put it in the literature, but I'm going to tell you about it first. So I have a gal, and this is actually one of a couple of people that I've seen this happen on, where she was 29 or 8 when she was diagnosed, a young Caucasian woman, 2 young children, married, and she was being cared for by another physician, and this was some years ago, I'm going to guess 3 years ago, was diagnosed with luminal B, sort of a ER-positive, PR-negative, high-grade, grade 3 breast cancer, HER2 negative, and she received AC followed by T, and she received tamoxifen, and she recurred a couple of years later in bone, extensive bone, and she was still being treated by another doc, and I think I saw her in consultation at that time, and I believe she received docetaxel and capecitabine, and she responded to docetaxel, capecitabine, and she did have, before her chemotherapy, I believe she had oophorectomy and an aromatase inhibitor. She did have a trial of another endocrine agent, and she went on to taxane, capecitabine, and she did benefit. And it wasn't one of those unbelievable multi-year responses that you can sometimes see with this particular luminal B biology. But she did respond. And then after she progressed, she went to liver, as is so often the case with these luminal Bs. They go bone, then they go bone liver. And she then received bevacizumab with vinorelbine, and she responded. And I think I had carboplatin in there at the same time in the beginning, but then she got, I believe that it might have been just bevacizumab and vinorelbine, and she responded to that. And then she progressed. And when she progressed on the bevacizumab and vinorelbine, her cancer really picked up speed, as I have been seeing somewhat, particularly in the liver. And so getting pretty nervous, she had had most of the major agents we have at this point. So in desperation, I drew a serum HER2. Now, this gal had been HER2 FISH negative and IHC negative on a couple of determinations. Strongly serum HER2 positive. Now, I've tried serum HER2, you know, with this conversion thing that's out there, oh, 6 or 8, 10 times over the last few years. And I've always been kind of disappointed in that. I haven't done a lot of serially biopsying, but I've found some serum, you know, some labs say 12.9, some labs say 14, but right in there, I've seen 14, 15, maybe 20 at the most, but nothing impressive. You know, this gal came back at like 75. And so I started treating her with gemcitabine, carboplatin, and trastuzumab. She's having a major response.
Tumor markers?
Big time, big time.
What were they and what are they now?
They were skyrocketing up big time, like doubling. They were up around, I believe we were in the 3,000 range. And she's having, every time I look, she's having coming down.
What is it now?
And her liver function tests are normalizing. She's only had like 2 cycles so far.
2 cycles.
And she's down to like maybe 1,200.
Any repeat imaging?
Not yet. Her liver function tests have pretty much normalized.
Did she have symptoms from the tumor?
Yes. Significant bone involvement and some just very bad fatigue.
Bone pain?
Pain.
So what's happened to pain and the fatigue?
Much better. And she's actually, I think she's been having some issues with depression. She's on an SSRI. She was sleeping a lot and just, but she actually was sitting up when I came in the exam room the other day. She's usually laying down. And she was sitting up when I came in the exam room. And so I've seen a couple of elevated serum HER2s after bevacizumab progression. My partner, Cindy Osborne, has a similar patient, and she gave trastuzumab, a very heavily pretreated patient. She gave the trastuzumab and the chemotherapy, too, and she also responded. So we're going to write up these patients.
I have to say, parenthetically, it's interesting. I want to get your take on this case, Hal, but it also raises the question of individualized, almost clinical research, you know, a case or a couple cases as a strategy. We think so much about huge randomized trials, and I know Joyce does this. She tinkers, she hypothesizes, and I think in a way, I'm not sure I know too many clinical investigators who have that kind of approach. What is this about serum HER2? Can you, Joyce, kind of go through? What do we know about serum HER2, and particularly in patients who have tumors that have been labeled as HER2 negative?
There are 2 papers in the literature, one from Alan Lipton looking at TAM versus letrozole up front and documenting that about a third of the patients had a significant elevation of their HER2 upon progression of, particularly on letrozole, but on both arms of the study. He published that in Cancer about 1 or 2 years ago. So that was documenting some elevation of the serum HER2. When you progress, HER1, HER2.
I mean, would you be thinking theoretically that if you biopsy the tumor, it would be HER2 positive at this point?
Yeah, or some upregulation of more HER2 perhaps than you had seen, not necessarily at the 3+
so
level.
So you were thinking she transformed?
Yes, I was thinking that, and there's a second paper too by Jonathan Orr, UHR at UT Southwestern, that showed pretty clearly in HER2 negative patients initially that circulating tumor cells, about 30% of them were HER2 positive.
I mean, did you think about biopsying her liver and actually
seeing? She had just finished Bev, and so I wasn't too excited about biopsying her liver. But if she hadn't been on Bev, you know, you might have considered it. Although, honestly, I have not in my own practice had a lot of success with this transforming thing where there's really been clinical implications from it. So biopsying organs that are not that easy to get at, like the liver, is something I have not done a lot of. Hmm. But the serum is different. And I have seen a couple of these patients. And so one hypothesis is that when you progress on Bev, whether or not HER2 may be a mechanism of resistance. So that's a hypothesis, and it certainly needs to be studied.
But is it being studied?
Not that I know of.
What do you think about that, Hal? I've never heard that before.
I'm not sure I have either. I think there's several different issues. I mean, obviously, this underscores the fact that we're treating advanced breast cancer based on the biology of the disease. And as our discussion in the first case focused on perhaps the need for new agents in these triple negatives, obviously we have several effective agents in treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer, and we tailor our therapies for the patient based on that. The question here is, what really is the nature of the tumor? And there obviously are several possibilities. One is that there's been bad testing, just not because of where it was, but just that there are variations in testing quality and reproducibility such that all along this was a HER2-positive tumor that somehow eluded easy characterization. And the second possibility is that there has been a shift, as was discussed, that a tumor that sort of began life as a HER2-negative breast cancer is now emerging as a HER2-driven breast cancer. And you're exactly right, of course, that Alan Lipton has shown in treatment of first-line endocrine therapy that rising serum HER2 levels have been associated with resistance to endocrine treatment, suggesting that perhaps as part of resistance to endocrine manipulations, there is relative overexpression of HER2. Whether that's the same phenomenon as the gene amplification that we think of as defining classic HER2-positive breast cancers is not clear. We rarely order serum HER2. Usually, we rely on the standard pathology characterization of the primary tumor and, if available, a biopsy of the metastatic sites. So this is an interesting case. I'm not aware of specific relationships between bevacizumab treatment and serum HER2 levels. It's hard to argue with obvious successful empiricism. If the patient's having a good response, you sort of take it in a case like that wherever you can get it.
Who does the test?
I believe it is FDA approved. I think Bayer Diagnostics,
which has been bought out by Siemens, and it's Oncogene, which was owned by Bayer, which has been bought out by Siemens.
So it's no problem getting the test.
It's a send out to Quest.
Oh, send out to Quest. So how long does it take to get back?
Probably by the time it's on your chart, a week.